This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, April 5th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, militants attack the U.S. consulate in Pakistan as bombings hit the northern part of the country. A government report cites problems with the controversial 287G program that allows local and state police to enforce immigration law. And we'll take a look at a growing rift between the U.S. and China over the valuation of currency. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. According to the website wikileaks.org, a video posted there today is, quote, a classified U.S. military video depicting the indiscriminate slaying of over a dozen people in the Iraqi suburb of New Baghdad, including two Reuters news staff. Reuters has purportedly been trying to obtain the video through the Freedom of Information Act without success since the 2007 attack. The video appears to be from a helicopter and shows the slaying of a wounded Reuters employee and his rescuers. In the video, a group of men seem to be relaxed and casually walking down a street. Notations on the video indicate two of the men are carrying cameras. Service personnel heard on the video indicate the men are armed. They request permission to fire, and permission is granted.
Roger. Crazy Horse, 1-8.
Oh yeah, look at those dead bastards.
The 17-minute video also reveals that two young children involved in rescue efforts were also seriously wounded. WikiLeaks claims to have gotten the video from military whistleblowers and says they have gone to great lengths to verify its authenticity. For the first time in more than 20 months, Israel allowed shipments of clothes and shoes into the Gaza Strip yesterday. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
According to Crossing's officials in Gaza, the shipment involved 10 trucks, but many of the goods contained in the trucks were damaged after spending 2 years in storage. Trade activity in the region has been blocked since Israel enforced a crippling blockade on the coastal enclave in June 2007, right after Hamas's takeover of Gaza amidst factional fighting with Fatah, the political party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Crossing's officials in Gaza say that the decision to allow the 10 trucks to enter Gaza came after a request from the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. There are still 600 more trucks of such goods waiting to be delivered to Gaza with no timeline for their entry. Israel continues to prevent essential goods from entering war-torn Gaza, such as road building materials. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Violence in Iraq continued today. Gunmen slaughtered a family, including four children under 12, about 25 miles south of Baghdad. No motive has been attributed to the murders. Yesterday, three suicide car bombs exploded within minutes of each other at diplomatic targets, including the German and Iranian embassies. 41 people were killed, more than 200 wounded. Authorities thwarted two other bomb attempts yesterday as well. This violence follows Friday's murders of some 24 extended family members, many of whom were members of Iraq's security forces known as the Awakening Council. Search and rescue teams in Mexicali, Mexico are working to free people still trapped in buildings after yesterday's earthquake. Dolores Imbernal reports.
Hospital patients in Mexicali remain evacuated and outdoors after a 7.2 magnitude earthquake shook northern Mexico on Sunday. Panic was rampant in the border city of Mexicali in Baja California, where about 900,000 people live. The earthquake's epicenter was located about 35 miles south of Mexicali, near the winery town of Guadalupe Victoria. The governor of Baja California confirmed that two people died as a result of the quake and about 100 were injured. Strong aftershocks followed the original quake, and Mexicans were advised by authorities to stay outside of damaged homes and buildings as a precaution. A major highway connecting Tijuana and Mexicali suffered some structural damage. Mexicans were cleaning up broken glass and other debris from homes and businesses this morning. Gonzalo Mesa, the owner of a restaurant supply store in Mexicali, said that his business has suffered damage that will cost him thousands of dollars.
And when we came to our business, we saw that everything was broken and you can see the damage all over, and I think it's all over Mexicali, and this thing is one of the hardest quakes we've had in a long, long time.
According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the earthquake was felt as far north as Santa Barbara, California, and as far east as Las Vegas. Dolores M. Bernal, FSRN, Mexicali.
According to a new study published today in the journal Pediatrics, breastfeeding infants for the first 6 months of life could save some 900 babies each year and could also save billions of dollars. The study's author, Dr. Melissa Bartrick of Harvard Medical School, says that breastfeeding may prevent stomach viruses, ear infections, asthma, juvenile diabetes, sudden infant death syndrome, and even childhood leukemia, all of which can cause expensive illnesses and even death. Bartrick characterizes breastfeeding as more than a lifestyle choice. She adds it to the list of public health issues. For Free Speech Radio News for WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Doreen Marina in New York. In Pakistan today, a series of bombings and attacks hit the northwest part of the country. A bomb blast in Lower Deer killed at least 30 people. Dawn News reports that the bombing took place during an open-air gathering organized by a secular political party, the Awami National Party. The gathering was to celebrate a recent proposal to change the name of the Northwest Frontier Province. A police chief in the area told AFP that the origin of the blast was being investigated, but that evidence so far indicates that it was a suicide attack. Meanwhile, in Peshawar, militants attacked the U.S. consulate. A video posted on the BBC shows blasts and uniformed gunmen firing into plumes of smoke as others carried the injured to safety. The consulate called it a coordinated attack that involved a vehicle suicide bomb and militants attempting to enter the building using grenades and weapons fire. The consulate also said two Pakistani security guards employed by the embassy were killed and others were seriously injured. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. A Taliban spokesperson told AFP by phone that the attacks were, quote, revenge for drone attacks in the area, and that the group planned to carry out more attacks to target any place where there are Americans. As violence in Pakistan continues, thousands of Pashtuns from the Northwest Frontier Province and tribal areas of Pakistan continue to flee the region. Many head to Dubai, where despite the global economic recession and a sluggish labor market, there's more job opportunities and a level of safety still elusive in Pakistan. FSRN's Scott Pham reads for our reporter in Dubai, Gabe Matthews.
In his apartment on Khalid bin Walid Street in Dubai City, 30-year-old Kari Ane Ihraman records an audio message. He's going to send it to his mother and other family members back in Pakistan. It's a long-standing tradition of Pashtuns living abroad to record messages on cassettes about how they're doing in their new country. In his message, Ane asks his family to pray for him and says he will definitely return to his beautiful hometown Swat one day. Ane left Swat during the war when he lost his job and business and came to Dubai to earn a living for his family. But he's been here a year and a half and is still jobless.
My village and my family members are a part of my soul, and I cannot forget them when I sleep, eat, and even enter a room. I compare how I would enter my home and hear how I enter my room. When you don't have a job at home, you can reduce grief by talking to family members or friends. But grief increases when you are jobless and living abroad far away from home.
Since Ane's visa is valid for 3 years, he wants to keep searching for a job.
No.
I try to test my luck here in Dubai. It is very difficult to get a job during the crisis, but I am hopeful. You have to be optimistic all the time. If I get a job of my choosing, then I will definitely earn more money here than in Swat, and I will be able to financially support my family. Although there's a financial crisis in Dubai, it is better than our country.
For those who do have jobs, the work can be long, strenuous, and underpaid. Inay's friend and roommate, Yunus Khan, is an electrician for Dubai's Sharjah Electricity and Water Authority.
I wake up very early in the morning. I work from 5 in the morning until 6 in the evening. I always work overtime, and then I get very tired and just want to sleep. On the weekends, I wash clothes because I do not have time at all during the week. It was my dream to come to Dubai because I did not know about the hardship here. Dubai seems shining and fun, but when you actually get here, you realize that it's not for common people like us. There are big shopping malls, but these are not for us. We can only clean or work as plumbers and electricians in the malls, but we can't shop there. We're poor people.
More than 300,000 Pashtuns live in Dubai, and many of them work as much as Khan in order to send money back to their families in Pakistan. There's not much time or money for entertainment, but on a recent evening, some Pashtuns gather for the official opening of the Dubai Festival. The annual event provides an opportunity for some Pashtuns to work, at least for a few months. Swat native Shahid Khan now makes a living selling crafts and has a booth at this festival.
I had my jewelry shop in Kalam Swat, a tourist area, but I left the business because of the terrible law and order situation. Now I am a salesman here in a craft shop. The expenses of my family are too much, but I fulfill the need for my family with my salary. My salary is not reduced due to the financial crisis, but the expenses are so high that it makes it difficult for me to survive. It is because the value of Pakistani money has been reduced so much.
Khan says he might return to Pakistan someday, but for now, he's staying in Dubai.
The security situation of Swat is the worst. Therefore, the business is extremely affected. The business can be relaunched only when the tourists will start visiting Swat. But I am afraid it is not possible because the security situation is unpredictable and there will be fear in tourists' minds.
The earning opportunities for business owners at the Dubai Festival are helping some Pashtuns get through the recession, including Kuda Baksh, who says he earns double what his brother earns in 1 year in Pakistan.
I have been in Dubai for the last 5 years for business. During the crisis in Swat, our business was completely destroyed, and that was a crucial time for us. But our business is saved because of the Dubai exhibition. The Pakistani government has not supported us in business, but we started an exhibition with our own money. It really supports us in our business. The business in Dubai was profitable, but even after the collapse during the financial crisis, it is far better than Swat, and I am still happy with what I earn. Our income has been reduced by 60% after the crisis, but it's still better than Pakistan in our area. We don't have any problems here in Dubai. We're very happy.
Although many expatriates are leaving Dubai due to the recession, many from Pakistan are staying. They say it's still a glittering place for most of the Pashtun community here compared to the violence and destruction in the tribal areas of Pakistan. For FSRN, this is Scott Pham reading for Gabe Matthews in Dubai.
I'm Jess Burns in Eugene, Oregon. For 10 years now, FSRN has been bringing you community news from around the world, including stories untouched by any other national broadcast media. FSRN has been able to do this thanks to a network of reporters deeply rooted in the communities we cover. FSRN needs our listeners to help nourish these deep roots. Visit fsrn.org to find out more and help us celebrate our 10-year anniversary.
Over the weekend, U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner said the Obama administration would delay a decision on whether to declare China a currency manipulator, a term that carries with it consequences under trade laws. The semiannual exchange rate report from the Treasury Department was due on April 15th, but Geithner said upcoming high-level meetings, including a G20 meeting and a U.S. visit by Chinese President Hu Jintao, would be a better way to address the issue. China's devaluation of its currency has been contentious for years. Critics say it gives the country an unfair advantage on world markets and threatens U.S. jobs. China calls it an internal matter. To learn more about this issue, we're joined by John Ciocciari. He served as a U.S. Treasury official from 2004 to 2007 and is now an assistant professor at the University of Michigan with a focus on Asia. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much.
Some economists have said that the Chinese have undervalued their currency, the renminbi, by as much as 40%. What does this mean?
The simplest way to understand it is to think that if the Chinese have undervalued their currency by 40%, then we, as U.S. citizens who purchase an imported good from China, are paying 40% less than we really ought to be for that Chinese good. And in exchange, Chinese purchasers of U.S. goods would be paying 40% more than they really ought to. And so it seemed to give China an unfair advantage in exporting to this country and putting up a wall to our ability to export to China.
And is there concern about that, the trade-off within China, the purchasing power of Chinese being diminished by this?
There certainly is. And as in most contentious political debates, there are actors who have very different perspectives. There are some Chinese, both in the government and in the private sector, who believe that it would be in the country's interest to increase the strength of the currency so that it would have the effect that you mentioned of allowing Chinese to purchase more desired foreign goods. But that's, to date, has largely been offset or outweighed by the government's interest in keeping export industries competitive and arguably at least securing an unfair advantage in trade with partners like the U.S.
Now, in his statement, U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner said that China's inflexible exchange rate has made it difficult for other emerging market economies to compete. So we hear a lot about the relationship between U.S. and China, but what are these other emerging market economies, and what is he saying here?
The thought is that if China keeps its currency unfairly cheap, that other countries, like, for example, Vietnam or Indonesia or India, have little choice but to keep their currencies cheap as well, or else they won't be able to compete with inexpensive Chinese goods in markets like here in the U.S. And what that does is it ties the hands of economic policymakers in those countries. They may have very good reasons in their domestic contexts for pursuing policies that would allow their currencies to appreciate, one example being raising the interest rate. But if they feel that they cannot do so without losing export competitiveness vis-a-vis China, they'll continue to follow policies that undervalue their currencies. And that can be detrimental. That can lead to things like the asset bubble that we've seen in many Asian countries and indeed all around the world in recent years.
The Chinese leader Hu Jintao is scheduled to visit Washington later this month. There are reports that he and President Obama had a phone conversation at the end of last week. Will this issue be on the table during this upcoming visit, and what's likely to come from it?
It will certainly be on the table. It may indeed be the first thing or one of the first things that Hu Jintao and Barack Obama discuss when they meet. It will also be front and center in the meetings, annual meetings of the IMF and World Bank later this month, as well as at meetings of the G20 and the strategic economic dialogue between U.S. and Chinese officials in May. What I would expect the U.S. officials to say is that China needs to revalue the currency, both for the sake of our bilateral relationship, but also to rebalance the global economy, and that China can choose to do so of its own volition, or it can face the increasing ire of the U.S. Congress. And so, in that sense, the U.S. government appears to be playing a little bit of a good cop, bad cop routine, where the administration will try to use persuasion But in the background will be this looming threat from Congress to impose stiff penalties if China does not agree to a more flexible currency regime.
And the timeline we're looking at, it seems, since this this report has been postponed until June, is the next 3 months or so. Is that right?
That's correct.
John Chiocciari has served as a U.S. Treasury official covering issues in international development and finance and is now an assistant professor at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
A new Homeland Security review of the controversial 287G program finds that local law enforcement agencies involved in immigration enforcement lack adequate oversight and training and need to do more to protect the civil rights of immigrants. Some critics also say the agreements that allow state and local police to enforce immigration rules are making communities less safe. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
The Department of Homeland Security has 287G agreements with more than 60 local law enforcement agencies around the country. The program uses local officers to do federal immigration activities. Back in 2002, when the program started, the cost was $5 million. Now it's $68 million. In addition, when the program first started, it resulted in about 6,200 individuals identified for deportation. In 2009, that number jumps to 62,000. But the program has serious flaws, according to Homeland Security's Inspector General. In a new 94-page report, the IG's office said the program lacks training, oversight, and a system to measure performance. Michelle Westland is Senior Policy Analyst with the Immigration Policy Center.
So what this means is that officers don't have training. They are not completely clear as to what they're supposed to be doing. They don't have the best understanding of immigration law or civil rights law. They are unaware of what their own authority is under the program, and they don't have supervision from ICE officers who are able to provide them that type of guidance.
The program has two models, jail or task force. In the first model, local officers work in jails or detention facilities and process those who are found not to have legal status. In the other model, officers identify and detain people who they think might be in the U.S. illegally while working their regular police beats. Again, Michelle Wasslin.
Even though one place might only have a jail model, they were in fact going beyond that and doing some of the things that you could do in a task force model. So they were overreaching the agreement that they have.
The program has drawn criticism in many communities. Aseda Shashashani is the Immigrants' Right Project Director with the ACLU in Georgia. She authored a report on how the program has been working in that state.
Racial profiling, it has led to erosion of trust between immigrant communities and local law enforcement, and as a result, it has led to really an unsafe atmosphere. And increasingly, immigrant communities are living in an atmosphere of isolation and terror because you know, if they've been a victim of a crime even, they are afraid to contact the police.
Some local law enforcement say they're taking steps to do things differently. Ed Wessing is a public information officer for the Mesa, Arizona Police Department. They just signed an agreement with the Department of Homeland Security last year. They say they'll be watching out for profiling by following protocol.
When we developed our policy, that was something that was considered. And clearly, not only is it a violation federally, but locally and by policy to have any bias-based policing, meaning policing based on someone's racial or ethnicity. Our specific policy and part of our agreement with 287G that we only get into immigration status when and if someone has been arrested and is being taken to our holding facility. So simply put, the policies that we have in place prevent that from beginning and from being issued to begin with.
But Arizona has a history of problems with its 287G agreements with Homeland Security. Maricopa County, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio has received national attention and widespread criticism for using the agreement to harass anyone with brown skin. Arpaio's office already has a racial profiling lawsuit pending. Michelle Wasslin of the Immigration Policy Center says with all the problems associated with these agreements, it's time to take a second look.
Given the fact that it's a highly ineffective program, and now we know very clearly that it's not being well run or implemented, I think it brings a serious doubt into whether or not this program should be continued.
The ACLU has already called for an end to the program. The Homeland Security Inspector General makes a number of recommendations to improve the 287G program, including collecting more data. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, is the process used to free up natural gas, often deep underground. For years, environmental groups in the West have claimed the process is dangerous to public health and contaminates drinking water. Companies say the process is not only safe, but essential. Now concerns about the process are reaching a national level as fracking becomes more common throughout the East. FSRN's Conrad Wilson reports.
The fracking process involves pumping water, sand, and chemicals into the ground at high pressure, breaking up the surrounding rock and creating tiny fissures for natural gas to make its way to the surface. The chemicals used make up a small part of the process, but their use is controversial. Claire Bassabell works with the nonprofit group Western Energy Project.
What's interesting is we keep hearing from the companies that there's nothing to worry about. There's nothing to worry about. But at the same time, these companies are refusing to disclose what is in their fracturing fluids.
The use of fracking chemicals is considered a trade secret, so companies don't want to share their unique recipes. Recently, some states, like Colorado, have passed laws that require companies to disclose their chemicals in certain instances, such as a medical emergency. But Bastable says the chemicals should be disclosed to the greater public.
It's such a curious situation because if it really wasn't a problem, why are they fighting so hard to not have to disclose?
Now there are efforts at the national level to shed light on a process that's long remained a mystery. Last month, the Environmental Protection Agency announced a nearly $2 million fracking study to see if it pollutes drinking water, as some claim. The long-anticipated study will begin this year with additional funding in 2011. The EPA says it will examine the nationwide impacts of fracking, but has offered few details of exactly what it will study.
Well, the study all comes back to secrets and transparency and the potential for water contamination.
That's Frank Smith. He's an energy organizer with the Colorado nonprofit Western Colorado Congress. Smith says he's aware of instances where fracking has contaminated water. He adds that the industry often claims their hydraulic fracking fluid is almost all water and sand.
However, that remaining few percentage points can contain items that are absolutely harmful to your health.
And there's other efforts to rein in fracking. A bill introduced last year in Congress would allow the EPA to regulate the hydraulic fracking process, require companies to disclose their fracking chemicals, and would do away with an exemption for fracking in the Safe Drinking Water Act. The bill is still in committee. Lawmakers and activists in Pennsylvania and New York are also concerned about fracking in a massive gas reserve called the Marcellus Shale. Facing additional regulation, the energy industry maintains that fracking is safe. Kathleen Sagama heads up government affairs for the Independent Petroleum Association of Mountain States, an industry trade group. Sagama says each time the EPA has looked at fracking, they've found no cases where it's contaminated water.
EPA studied fracking under the Clinton administration and found no cases. Studied it again under the Bush administration and found no cases. If we need to do it under the Obama administration and find no cases, you know, hopefully that'll be enough bipartisanship to put the issue to rest. And that's why we're really hoping that it is a very credible and scientific study.
In 2004, the EPA conducted a controversial study that found fracking did not impact or threaten drinking water. Environmental groups have criticized that report largely because the government did not test any water before deeming the process safe. Conrad Wilson, FSRN, Carbondale, Colorado.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Today's headlines editor was Nell Abram. Washington, D.C. editor was Karen Miller. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. Check out our Deep Roots 10-year anniversary campaign. That's at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.